You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
Hollywood is yours. To unlock the secret history of Hollywood, simply go to patreon.com/attaboysecret or follow the link in the show notes of this episode.
The spectacular pageantry of Footlight Parade had done more than demonstrate James Cagney's boundless talents to the world. They'd lifted the spirits of a forlorn nation still lost in the Great Depression. The film was packed to bursting with working-class heroes, zesty comedy, romance, beautiful girls, beautiful boys, adventure, music, and of course, dancing. In fact, the dancing on display gave new meaning to the word. Intricately designed, faultlessly choreographed works of art by the master of the grand illusion, Busby Berkeley, crowned by the now legendary Bayer waterfall sequence, featuring a human waterfall built with hundreds of glamorous beauties who each break away to form hypnotic, geometric patterns in the water. The cost of producing the film ran to over $700,000, but took almost $2 million at the box office when it was released. For Jimmy, it was, he hoped, the beginning of a new career path at Warner Brothers. Footlight Parade showed that he could do much more than look mean and slug jaws. He could also sing, dance, and romance when called upon to do so. And with his name once again being praised by infatuated critics, and with a $2 million blockbuster trailing in his wake, he eagerly anticipated his next assignment. He was therefore a little crestfallen when he was sent over to work for Roy Del Ruth once more on Lady Killer, the peculiar story of a con man, Dan Quigley, who escapes the clutches of his gang by heading west and accidentally stumbles into a career as a movie star.
So your old friends aren't good enough for you anymore, huh? Let me give you a tip. You know, I can change all this good luck of yours. If I ever whisper in a cop's ear what I know about you, say, I think you better start being nice to Mama. Yes?
You're still going out.
The movie reteamed him with Mae Clark, who'd infamously received half a grapefruit in the face during their last outing, The Public Enemy. Here, she plays Myra Gale, the no-good gang mole who attempts to use her feminine wiles to draw the now-famous Quigley back into a life of crime. She's repaid for this endeavor when Cagney grabs her by the hair and throws her out of his hotel room. Though the scene was actually played more for laughs than shocks this time, it quickly became the main talking point among critics, who wondered how Cagney was going to beat Mae Clark up the next time they met. His next assignment was Jimmy the Gent, another role that saw him as the brash criminal type, an unscrupulous scoundrel who makes a living by tracking down missing heirs to estates that have gone unclaimed and taking a healthy cut for himself.
Now look, you beat it down to the Farmers Loan and Trust Company and bribe that dumb vault man to give you all the dope on that old lady. Get it? And look, if you miss anything, you get lumps.
So annoyed was Jimmy that he'd once again been saddled with a second-rate part that he decided to protest by having his hair coarsely shaved at the sides and back, which made him look like a street alley thug. When Jack Warner saw Cagney's haircut, he flew into a blind rage on the set. Now, said Jimmy. You wanted a thug, you got a thug. To punish him, Jack Warner next assigned Jimmy to yet another criminal role. This time, alongside his old friend Joan Blondell. The film, He Was Her Man, saw Jimmy take on the role of Flicker Hayes, a gangster on the run with his girlfriend, Rose, who takes refuge in a small village. He can shave his hair if he likes, Jack snarled. The worse he looks this time, the better. On the first day of shooting, Jack himself arrived at the set, gleefully expecting to see Jimmy with an even more thuggish haircut, but instead was horrified to discover that Jimmy had regrown his hair with the addition of a suave moustache.
"What are you doing?" he said. "Get that thing off your face!"
"Don't you like it?" Jimmy grinned, smoothing it with his fingers. "I think it makes me look rather dashing."
"You're supposed to be a tough guy," Jack shouted.
"So you keep telling me," said Jimmy, who winked and marched to the set, clapping his hands.
"Now, everyone," he called out, "let's all go out there and make some magic, shall we?"
Jack watched him, his jaw wobbling in fury, then glanced over to Joan Blondell, who cleared her throat and tried not to laugh. On his next movie, Here Comes the Navy, Jimmy was given the part of Chesty O'Connor, who falls out at the film's outset with Naval Officer Biff Martin over a dancer.
"Hey! Sorry, sailor, I'm cutting in.
Have an auto with a sledgehammer.
Drop it, you two guys. You want to break up the dance? There's an alley outside for this kind of stuff.
That's okay with me.
And it goes double with me.
Well, come on. Relax, honey. I'll be right back. This won't take long."
The fight spills out into the alley where Chesty gets knocked clean out by Martin. Swearing revenge, Chesty joins the Navy just to get a poke at Martin, falling in love with Gloria Stewart along the way, little realizing that she's Biff Martin's sister. Although he was again playing a hothead, the film was lighter in tone, and Jimmy found much to enjoy during the making of it. Firstly, large parts of the film were set on a boat, and Jimmy loved the water. Secondly, he was partnered again with Frank McHugh. Thirdly, and most importantly, he made a friend for life in the actor playing Biff Martin, an actor he'd met briefly in New York in 1926, and one that would remain close to him for the rest of his life, Mr. Pat O'Brien. On paper, the friendship should never have worked. O'Brien was a hard-drinking party animal who rarely saw an evening at home, preferring instead to linger long in the night spots of Hollywood, standing at the piano and belting out a tune until being ejected at 6 a.m. by grouchy proprietors who wanted some sleep. Jimmy, on the other hand, could hardly stand the nightlife of Hollywood. Pleasure to him was a cozy evening in with Bill, and perhaps a few friends around for dinner. On those rare occasions that he did venture out for the evening, it was always to a restaurant, and then home by 11, the time at which O'Brien was usually just beginning. Perhaps it was the Irish heritage the two men shared that drew Jimmy to him. Or more likely, it was that O'Brien in many ways reminded Jimmy of his own father, a man prone to lengthy indulgences and fabulous odysseys. However, in O'Brien's case, the liquor never seemed to get the better of him. The many glasses of O'Brien's favourite drink, Cutty Sark whiskey, would flow wild and free. A fellow that dared to try and keep up with O'Brien drink for drink would soon find himself either asleep or in need of medical attention. But at a certain point in proceedings, the hand would cover the glass when the bottle was offered, and O'Brien would refuse to drink on. Unlike Jimmy's father, he knew when to stop and could easily enjoy an evening without the stimulation of alcohol. On the last day of filming, Cagney, O'Brien and McHugh decided to go for dinner at Chasen's to send off the film. On their way out of the studio, they happened into Spencer Tracy, who was at a loose end, and invited him along. The food was excellent, the drinks flowed freely, and from 7 until midnight the four men animatedly swapped stories and jokes, leaning into a huddle and laughing heartily over the table. Such was their mood at the evening's close that they all eagerly agreed to meet the following week, this time at Romanoff's. The group that met the following week was slightly larger. By now, word had spread about the boys' gathering, and the dining group had swelled to include Ralph Bellamy, Alan Jenkins, Bert Lahr and Frank Morgan, who would both find eternal fame as, respectively, the Cowardly Lion and the Wizard himself in The Wizard of Oz in 1939. Lynn Overman, who was in high demand as a supporting player, made the group a nine. The meals and drinks progressed much in the manner of the preceding week, and with the added members, there was no shortage of wild stories and peculiar anecdotes. The meetings ever afterwards were firmly a weekly fixture for the nine men, who all eagerly anticipated their time together each week to swap the latest jokes and to even give each other career advice. Rhythm is our business, business show us well. Our purpose was just to get together for conversation and laughs, said Frank McHugh. Generally, the conversation was about wine, women, and song, just boys getting together. Once in a while, it would be an exchange of opinions about a picture or a role. Once, when Spence was considering Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, he asked the group if he should do it. Lynn Overman said no. Spence asked why, and Lynn replied, "You wouldn't be good in it." Well, Spence bristled at that and asked with indignation, "Just why wouldn't I be good in it?" Lynn replied in his quite matchless way, "Nobody ever is." And he was right. Spence went ahead anyway, did the part, and failed. From each other we learned about pictures and the trends, and most of all, we kept our friendship alive. And we had a lot of fun in the bargain. News of the Cagney Boys Club soon spread around Hollywood, and because of the faint hint of Irish blood in the group, the gossip columnist Sidney Skolsky dubbed the group the Irish Mafia, a term that no one in the Boys Club, as they preferred to call it, approved of. "Our purpose," said Jimmy, "was to meet, talk, find out what was happening with one another, and have a night out. Some people accuse us of plotting to help the Irish-American army, and we were also charged with being anti-this and anti-that. One of the most fantastic ideas that got around was that our conversation was profound." One such party crusher was Zachary Scott, who during the later years of the group staggered over and chose the worst opening gambit possible.
"How do you join this Irish mafia?" he slurred.
"You don't get to," said McHugh. "You are asked." Lynn Overman then cast a withering eye over Scott and purred, "And we are all out of asks." Ralph Bellamy dealt the killing blow by shooing Scott away with the words,
"Exit, gypsy."
The Boys Club provided something that Jimmy needed badly. A second family. A table filled with new brothers who, despite their Hollywood stardom, were still just a bunch of guys who needed a friend from time to time in the choppy, uncertain waters of Hollywood. Jimmy finished the year by starring in The St. Louis Kid, another runaway success that saw him as a truck driver who takes on the unions after a strike leader is killed and Jimmy's girlfriend is kidnapped. The film was another quickie. In fact, it was shot in only 2 weeks and cost the measly sum of $80,000 to make. But because of the Cagney name, it took nearly $2 million at the box office. 1935 saw a drastic change in the types of roles he was assigned to. Devil Dogs of the Air saw Jimmy as a daring Marine Corps pilot, battling in the air and on the ground against Pat O'Brien for the hand of Margaret Lindsay. G-Men took the wild step of placing Jimmy firmly on the side of the law, this time as FBI agent Brick Davis, a former petty criminal turned government agent who goes to war with his old gang. By now, his salary had reached the dizzying heights promised by Jack Warner during their last bout of fisticuffs. $4,500 was finding its way home to the Cagneys each and every week, placing Jimmy strictly on the rich list with an annual salary of just over $230,000. But this sum still paled against the vast sums of money that Jimmy's name was attracting. Every film he'd made during the past 18 months had earned a profit of well over $1 million each time, and Jimmy's stock in Hollywood was reaching dizzying proportions. The third film of 1935 was The Irish in Us, which saw Cagney and O'Brien again do battle for the affections of a girl, this time Warner's delicate new star, a 19-year-old Olivia de Havilland, who Jimmy referred to for many years afterwards as his most beautiful leading lady in films. From here to the most radical of departures, the role of Bottom in Warner's lavish production of A Midsummer Night's Dream, directed by Max Reinhardt. For once, Jimmy was disconcerted by the change of pace, and when he was told he'd been given the role, he actively tried to escape it. "I did not want to play Bottom," he said. I fought against it. Somebody told me that Max Reinhardt had seen me in Lady Killer and remembered my performance. He looked at me all the time and said, "Ein guter Schauspieler," which meant a good actor. The only thing I was going by is that Bottom was the greatest ham that Shakespeare had ever written. The keynote was that the son of a bitch was a ham. I don't know what the hell they wanted. For the first time, the critics were unkind to a Cagney performance. The Times of London stated that the most lamentable mistake in the cast was the Bottom of James Cagney. He seemed to me to misconceive the character, and only became tolerable in the scene where he discovers the ass's head on his shoulders. Before he could catch his breath, Jimmy was being dressed up in wing collars and waistcoats to star as the wonderfully named Bat Morgan in Frisco Kid, the tale of vice and corruption on the Barbary Coast of 1850. A thoroughly mediocre movie that took another King's Ransom at the box office, despite Jimmy's ridiculous poodle-like hairstyle. Jimmy's contract stated quite plainly that he would only star in 4 movies per year, and with the completion of Frisco Kid, he was legally allowed to relax until 1936. But by now, Jack Warner had begun to grow tired of his biggest star's demands, and sent down the edict to stick him in one more. The movie was Ceiling Zero, an adventure drama set around the Federal Airlines Company and the men who work there. Pat O'Brien took the role of Jake Lee, the responsible boss, while Jimmy was cast as Dizzy Davis, his reckless, untamed friend and the best pilot in the outfit. When his careless actions lead to a fellow aviator's death, Dizzy is consumed by guilt and gives his life for the greater good. Despite being made to work outside of his contractual obligations, Cagney was always happy to spend time with Pat O'Brien and bit his tongue. Perhaps if Jack Warner hadn't decided to rock the boat even more, then things would have been okay. On the day that Ceiling Zero was released in cinemas, Jimmy received a call from a pal who was also a newspaper man to ask him if he'd seen the marquees on the Warner theatres. Jimmy said that he hadn't. The friend suggested that he get himself down to one of them to take a look. Jimmy arrived at a Warner Theatre in Hollywood to see a giant marquee sign outside reading, "Pat O'Brien in Ceiling Zero." Jimmy had nothing but love and admiration for Pat O'Brien, but the marquee was in direct violation of the contract he'd agreed with Jack Warner, which clearly stated that Jimmy was at all times to receive top billing in any film he starred in. Twice in as many months, Jack Warner had gone back on his word. Firstly, he'd made him work in 5 films when he was only supposed to be starring in 4. Now he was receiving second billing. Jimmy had a photograph taken of the marquee and before the morning was over, had instructed a lawyer to begin legal proceedings against Warner Brothers, an unprecedented move in Hollywood, where the limitless wealth and influence of powerful studio heads had always frightened stars into submission. Walking out of a studio was one thing, but to actively take them on in court was another. Many considered the move naive, many thought him a fool, but the combined minds and vast resources of the Warner Brothers legal department didn't scare Jimmy one bit. A day later, he was invited to Jack Warner's office to see if things couldn't be straightened out man to man. Part of him had wanted to ignore the offer, but the hot rebel in his heart also wanted to hear what Jack had to say for himself. And so, the following evening, he drove himself to the Warner studio and presented himself at Jack Warner's office. Jack was not wearing his usual knowing grin. He greeted Jimmy with a curt nod and pointed to a chair. Long shadows of anger hung around his eyes. It was obvious that he was having trouble restraining himself. "I'm disappointed, Jim," said Jack, finally. "I thought we had all these issues straightened out. I think we've been good to you. I don't think you can say that we haven't. To put it plainly, I'm starting to get a little tired of your ego. I think it might do you good to remember that you're an employee here, just like several thousands more. And no one in the history of this studio has ever given me the shank as many times as you have." Jack took a breath and began to pace. You sign a contract and then you get bored of the contract. Suddenly the things you agreed to when you signed aren't good enough anymore. Maybe it was the way that you've been educated about these things. Maybe it's your lack of experience in all things legal. But if you're unhappy with the contract, then you damn well see the thing out before you start complaining. The problem with you, Jim, is that you think you're better than everyone else. You have a few hits and you think you're indispensable. No one is indispensable. I have 40 other guys out there who'd kill to star in the films you've been in. Jack and Jimmy locked eyes for a long time, and then Jimmy took a breath. You know, I owe you a lot, he said. Because of you, my kid sister's going to college, and she has a savings account. My mother has a cute little house in Brooklyn. My wife and I have enough money to last us until we're old and gray. If we wanted to, we could sit by a lake and read for the rest of our lives, and all that is because of your money. The problem with you, Mr. Warner, is that money is all you have to give. To tell you the truth, I would have taken a pay cut in exchange for a little respect. You say you've made me rich. Well, I've made you far richer. That, to me, makes us evens. Who the hell do you think you are? Jack hissed. I never agreed an even split with you. I don't turn kids into movie stars and go 50-50. You're here to make money. Your very reason for being here is to make this studio rich. I've made money for this studio, said Jimmy. I would have kept on making money for this studio, but you haven't kept to our agreement. I made an extra movie for you for free this year, and you pay me back by putting me halfway down the bill. This is my goddamn studio, screamed Jack. If I want to dress you up as Bo Peep and make you sing lullabies, then you'll damn well do it, because you're mine. You see, all these threats hinge on one important point. The guy on this side of the desk has to care about being a movie star. You see, that's why they don't work on me, because I don't care a whit. It's just a job. You seem to think that you can stand there and use "you'll never work in this town again" at me. Well, Mr. Warner, there are other towns. And you know what else? There are other careers. He stood up and walked to the door. If you walk out of that door, Jim, then it's over. There's no coming back this time. You will no longer be a part of Warner Brothers or Hollywood. I'll make sure you never get to come back. No one will employ you. I'll see to that even if I have to buy off the whole town. Not one door will be open to you. You'll be finished in Hollywood. Jimmy turned around and faced Jack Warner. You know, I would ask you for that in writing, but it seems slightly inappropriate. Jack watched him leave, then sat down and spent a few minutes catching his breath. One thought ran again and again through his head. No one did this to Jack Warner and got away with it. Harry Warner arrived in St. Louis under the smoldering glare of the national press to face the charges of antitrust being brought against him by the federal government. Even the judge presiding over the matter opened his account with the jury by telling them that practices such as the ones perpetrated deserve the full extent of the law. This was no trifling matter. If convicted, Harry Warner wasn't facing a fine and a court order. He was going to jail for 2 years. Any hope of a swift and favorable conclusion to the case was crushed on the first day. To stoke the furnace of fury among the 12 jurors, the government prosecutor had begun his day in court by preaching that Harry Warner and the 6 others being tried alongside him were nothing more than pigs at the trough, greedy businessmen without morals, the same kind of men that had caused the depression, that had weakened and crippled their great land. By freezing out the little guy, the prosecutor said, Harry Warner had learned nothing from America's ills. In fact, he was the poison that prevented an upturned country from righting itself. The case ran for a week, and then a fortnight, and then a month. Each and every day, Harry would report to the court and have to endure the scathing words of the prosecutor until the afternoon, when he would return alone to his hotel room and wait silently until the morning came. The federal case against him was bad enough, but the loneliness was acutely painful. There was no question of his family's joining him. The girls were at a crucial point in their school lives, and Ray had her hands full at home. What had begun as a week at most had spiraled into a nightmare without horizon. But more than anything, Harry Warner was feeling all of his 53 years and wanted nothing more than to have his family near to him. Darlings, he wrote in a letter to Betty and Lita, I'm hoping that this case will be over so that I can be home with you and your mother next Saturday. It is favorable that I may. It is so lonesome here without you all. Otherwise, Daddy is feeling fine. Love and kisses to both of you and Mother. Kiss her for me. Your loving Dad. A week later, he wrote again. It feels like years since I saw you two, and I hope it will soon be over, but it looks like another 10 days. Dad. 2 months after the case had begun, the day finally came for both sides to conclude their arguments. The prosecution confidently argued that Harry Warner was the devil, and that by convicting him, the jurors could send out a message to those who dared to believe they could keep the American spirit down. Harry's heart sank, and for the first time, he looked carefully across the faces of the attentive 12 men who sat outraged, listening to the sugared words of the prosecutor, and nodding without meaning to. But not everyone was transfixed by the prosecutor. A single pair of eyes looked back at Harry. On the back row, 2 seats from the right, sat a proud black man, aged around 40, who listened to the prosecutor's damning opinion of Harry Warner, while trying to size the man up for himself. For a moment, the 2 men stared at each other, and then the man looked away to the animated theatrics of the prosecutor. Harry leaned over to his lawyer. I want you to play up the point that I'm Jewish, he whispered. Why? Came the reply. Trust me, said Harry. Forget what you were going to say. I want you to stress the persecution that Jews have received in America. The lawyer frowned and then followed Harry's eyes to the jury box and nodded in agreement. Harry's lawyer climbed to his feet and began to deliver his closing rebuttal. He agreed with the prosecution that the few were sometimes victimized by the many. Hadn't it been so when Harry Warner had arrived in America? Hadn't it been so during the many years he'd been running Warner Brothers? Harry Warner was not a man to bully. How could anyone think such a thing of a man who'd spent his life fighting anti-Semitism? He was a victim, not a tyrant. The jury were released to deliberate. As they left the court, Harry caught sight of the black juror, who glanced at him and smiled. The deliberations ran until the evening, and still an outcome could not be decided. A harassed clerk rushed from a doorway to tell the judge that the jury could not reach a conclusion, and an overnight recess was granted. The next day, Harry paced the same 6 feet of courtroom floor for 11 hours, before being told that the jury was still unable to reach a verdict. A day later, news arrived that no decision could be definitely agreed upon. 11 of the jurors had voted to find Harry guilty. There was, apparently, one holdout who would not change his mind. Frustrated, the judge declared a hung jury and a retrial was ordered. Within an hour of leaving the courtroom, Harry had sold his St. Louis movie houses, and the whole problem vanished with them. The matter was never again brought to court. On his last night in St. Louis, he called Albert to check on things in New York.
Your family's fine,
he said.
I had dinner with them last night. They're looking forward to seeing you again. Lita's been drawing you pictures. She's going to call you tonight.
Harry smiled. And what about business? The line fell silent. Albert?
Yeah, the projectionist union isn't happy. They're saying the strike is on next week if we don't at least sit around a table with them and talk, bunch of bums.
I'll deal with them when I get back, said Harry. Any word on Jack?
Jack's Jack. You don't want to know.
No, I don't think I do.
Irma called me. About the kid, you know, the girl? She thinks Jack and Anne had the kid before the divorce happened. Everyone does. Breaks her heart.
You know, the one good thing about it all is that Mama and Papa didn't live to see it.
Or Sam,
said Albert.
Sam would have kicked his ass.
The two men chuckled and said their goodnights. Harry spent the next hour folding his clothes carefully and packing for the morning's trip. At 10 p.m., he climbed into bed, and by 5:30, he was sound asleep. The phone rang at 11:15 and Harry awoke with a start. He fumbled for his glasses and blearily read the clock. Perhaps it was Lita making her promised call, but surely it was past midnight in New York. He grabbed up the receiver and cleared his throat. Yes, hello? On the other end of the line, he heard the faint ghost of traffic noises, and then a sharp intake of breath, followed by a voice he'd never heard before.
Mr. Warner? This is just a friendly call to let you know that before you get back to New York, we will have kidnapped both of your daughters.
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to continue this epic story immediately, then go on over now to patreon.com/attaboysecret or follow the link in the show notes of this episode. Hear every thrill, every drama, every heartbreak, every spellbinding moment. Unlock the secret history of Hollywood now at patreon.com/attaboysecret. Or follow the link in the show notes of this episode. And thank you.